The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest Insurance Group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine, March 9, 2026 edition. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time is in large block capital lettering in white, superimposed upon various colors because this front cover shows photographs of the head and shoulders of nine people, male and female. And I don't have all of their names, but that's what it is. It says the people versus AI. Education, the new brain drain. For decades, the U.S. has attracted talented scientists from all over the world. That may be Changing by Veronique Greenwood, Vienna. It all started promisingly enough. French biologist Gabriella Lubinska had enjoyed her PhD training, researching how organisms change over time. Arriving at Harvard Medical School in September 2024, she hoped for more of the same. She planned to look at how, over the course of a lifetime, healthy cells change into diseased ones. Donald Trump won the presidential election shortly after her arrival, and before long things went downhill. In the spring, the grant paying her salary, along with thousands of others, was cut. In April, the White House proposed cutting by 40% the budget of the U.S. National Institutes of Health, NIH, which is the largest public funder of biomedical research in the country. Then the government withdrew Harvard's ability to provide visas for international researchers like Lubinska. While a court allowed Harvard to sponsor visas for the time being, Lubinska was questioning why she was in the U.S. There are places where I could go to do science, she recalls thinking, without all this. Soon she had a job offer from AITHYRA, Athira, perhaps, a new institute for biomedicine and AI in Vienna. And when she heard of a new Austrian fellowship called APART USA, specifically for people leaving American institutions, with a generous 4 years of research funding, she applied and got it. Now she lives in the city where before Vienna's scientific community was devastated by World Wars I and II, blood types were discovered, cosmic rays were first identified, and psychoanalysis was born. All around her are architectural remnants of those heady days, like the 1910 Art Nouveau Observatory on the edge of the Danube Canal. Reminders that a place's status as a scientific powerhouse is only as secure as the geopolitics that surrounds it. Lubinsky's just the kind of scientist that Heinz Fossmann, president of the Austrian Academy of Sciences, hoped to lure to Austria with the APART USA fellowship. He saw the instability in the U.S., while regrettable for science, as an opportunity for Austria to reclaim some of this scientific glory. If the U.S. keeps cutting budgets, he says, we will keep scooping up the good people. By September 2025, 25 candidates had been accepted, including Lubinska. The APART USA fellows were not the only ones looking beyond U.S. borders. Nature, a leading science journal, reported in April 2025 that through the job board it maintains, U.S. scientists submitted 32% more applications for jobs abroad between January and March 2025 than during the same period in 2024. U.S. page views of job postings abroad also spiked in March alone as the administration intensified its cuts to science. Views rose by 68% compared with the same month last year, Nature wrote. It goes on, in May 2025, the EU granted 500 million euros in funding for the Choose Europe initiative, intended to help draw international researchers. In April, the president of Germany's Max Planck Society announced the Max Planck Transatlantic Program, stating it will include roles for researchers who are looking to leave the U.S. The French government also revealed 100 million euros in funding to attract international scientists. The United States profited from the migration flow of highly qualified persons decades after the Second World War, Fossman says, and now it's maybe the first time we can move around this migration direction, that Europe can profit from the talents that are educated in the United States. The U.S. was not always a magnet for scientists. Hardly anyone in the United States devotes himself to the essentially theoretical and abstract portion of human knowledge, wrote Alexis de Tocqueville in Democracy in America in 1840. In the late 19th century, Germany was the global leader in scientific research. It would be quite some time before the image of Americans as unimaginative backwoodsmen began to shift. And in the early 20th century, apart from agricultural research, American science was often supported by philanthropy and individual states rather than by the federal government. After the Nazis took power in Germany in 1933, however, European researchers, including Albert Einstein most famously, headed in great numbers to the U.S. In 1939, just before war was declared, Einstein wrote to President Franklin D. Roosevelt warning Germany had the brain power and resources to create atomic weapons. FDR responded with the Manhattan Project, which employed many fleeing physicists and eventually developed the atomic bomb. Congress had new respect for the possibilities of research after that, and the flow of scientists into the U.S. accelerated. By the mid-20th century, the U.S. had turned into a haven for international talent. Before the war, American science had been notably less hierarchical than in many European institutions. Instead of having to spend years as an assistant to a senior professor, as in Germany, a young professor in America was largely a free agent, explains Daniel Kevlis, a retired science historian at Yale University. There was a great deal of freedom to do what you wanted, and after the war, European science lay in shambles. There was no comparison between what awaited European scientists in the U.S. and what they could do at home. The U.S. also had an unusually large system of nationally funded labs, notable for their dedication to basic research. The peculiar openness of American society, scientists could bring their families and become citizens, added to the appeal, says Catherine Westfall, a science historian now retired from Michigan State University. This was part of a particular mindset in the government, explains sociologist of science Olof Hollensten of Sweden's Lund University. You maintain a big brain trust in the universities, in these big research centers, and you let people do more or less what they want, he says, because when the time comes that this whole brain trust needs to be mobilized, we can then pool all these resources into specific problem solving. To be sure, American science has had its ups and downs. Senator Joseph McCarthy targeted scientists in his 1950s red baiting campaign, including prominent figures like physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer. The center of gravity for nuclear physics moved back to Europe after American funding for a new collider collapsed in 1993, and it has never been unusual for researchers trained in the U.S., American or otherwise, to move abroad, taking a job wherever their particular flavor of science is in demand. But in recent years, U.S. public and private sources were the largest funders of all research and development on the planet, and the country was a net importer of scientists. For many scientists, the U.S. had become a hub where many were educated and hoped to stay. Now that status may be shifting. Italian physicist Andrea Uru moved to the U.S. in 2023 to work on magnetism at Rutgers University. He was considering the possibility of securing a faculty position in the U.S. At the same time, he looked at jobs closer to home. Developing an academic career in this country would be absolutely great, he says. However, the National Science Foundation, a major funder of basic science, came under threat from government cuts last year. That option became even fainter, and I decided to direct my efforts towards getting funds in Europe. Uru will soon move to the University of Cagliari in Sardinia. American geneticist Audrey Lynn studies evolution using ancient DNA, with a particular focus on how dogs were domesticated. In the spring of 2025, when she was applying, the job situation in the U.S. was very unstable, with a lot of faculty job searches being canceled or postponed, she says. But science does not stop. I've spent almost a decade of my life training and working on my research, and this is what I've chosen to dedicate my life to, and I have to go where I can do this. She, too, is now an APART USA fellow and arrived in Austria in February. Europe likely cannot compete with what the U.S. traditionally spends on science. As a whole, the continent funds about 20% of the world's research and development, compared with the U.S.'s roughly 29%. According to numbers compiled by the American Association for the Advancement of Science. What's more, large investments in basic science are usually the purview of a rapidly growing economy, Hollinson says, which Europe's is not. The reason China has been investing so much in science and technology in the past 20 to 30 years, of course, is they have the money. They need to invest in something, he says. The same thing was true for the United States after World War II. China now funds around 28% of the world's R&D, but Hollinson and other experts are not convinced the country will build a similar research environment to that of the U.S. Many researchers moving to China from abroad these days are U.S.-educated Chinese scientists, says Deborah Seligson, professor of political science at Villanova University. People returning home rather than immigrants. But Europe can try to provide some of what has historically been appealing about American science. At the Institute of Science and Technology, Austria, in the Vienna Woods, new buildings have been springing up like mushrooms of steel and glass, labs where that culture of freedom is being carefully cultivated. Italian biologist Elia Mascolo, who uses information theory to study how genes work, was attracted by the cluster of researchers already at ISTA. Working with specific people was also why he'd spent 4 years in the U.S. and why he might have stayed longer if the right job had come along. But when the APART USA fellowship was announced he signed on. "It's so niche, my research," he says, sitting in a glass-walled pavilion on the campus, which is studded with quirky public art and bridges between buildings. "It's a common refrain among scientists. They have to go where the funding and support for their specific work is." What does the U.S. stand to lose if it is no longer a hub for science? I think what we're going to see now is a dispersal of scientific talent, and I think that's costly, not just to the United States, but to the world, says Seligson. If you think about a long-term history of global development, there's usually been a scientific hub when there are a lot of advances, whether that hub was Paris or Berlin or the United States. As well, work from economists who study technological innovation has found it increasingly depends on basic science. Since 1975, the percentage of new U.S. patents drawing on federally funded science has roughly tripled to nearly a third of all patents filed. What the U.S. gives up, others stand to take. Fossmann says Austria is not rescuing these scientists. It's making a calculated attempt to redirect the flow of scientific migration. Since Trump took office in January 2025, nearly 8,000 research grants have been canceled or frozen, and around 25,000 federal scientists and employees of research agencies have lost their jobs, Nature has reported. The effects are still rippling through American institutions, and the long-term consequences of this upheaval remain to be seen. However unstable the landscape is for scientists in the U.S., there is no guarantee of solid ground abroad either. The world is a tumultuous place. Westfall, the American science historian, attended a recent physics meeting at CERN, one of the world's largest institutions for scientific research. She sensed European scientists also did not feel particularly at ease. "Everybody's feeling the insecurity about Russia and Ukraine," she says, "and there are fears that government spending in Europe might increasingly turn toward defense at the expense of funding for science." The picture in the U.S. continues to be uncertain and hard to read. There have been some changes since Lobinska's successful spring. Harvard enrolled a record number of international students in 2025, and Congress has pushed back against the budget proposed by the administration, refusing many funding cuts to science. In the meantime, scientists continue to have to decide where they're going to take their work, each one making the call on where they think they'll best be able to thrive. For chemist Yassin El Abiad, and a part USA fellow, leaving the U.S. led to a homecoming. He grew up not far from Vienna and was educated there. He spent several years in the U.S. mainly because he, like Moscolo, wanted to work with a particular researcher. "The U.S. is where the money is, and that's what brings more people there," he says on a cold morning in January in his new lab. "That's how it rolls. And if that ever turns around, I don't know," he sighs. Finally, he puts words to what's on his mind. "All the greatest researchers used to be in Germany," he says, "and in other parts of Europe. You can still see many of these old buildings in Vienna. Austria was huge in science." At the University of Vienna in the chemistry department, there still stands a lecture hall that looks just as it did when Einstein was photographed attending a lecture there, not all that long before Nazis took over the country. The U.S. is where people go to do science for the moment. "But things change," El Abiad says. "Let's see what happens." There's a photo here. It's half a page, very colorful, because on the back wall is a large wooden bookcase with, at least 20 shelves filled with books, and they're all colorful volumes. Everything on the light spectrum from white to black, and all the bright ones in between, red and purple and blue and yellow. In front of that large bookcase. This is a large desk. It's a wooden-topped desk. It's filled with books and magazines and papers, and seated behind the desk is what looks like a quintessential professorial figure, dressed in a dark gray suit, white shirt, gray and red striped tie, with his he's seated with his hands clasped in front of him. On the desktop is a man smiling at the camera. Short graying hair, short gray facial hair, glasses. His eyes look blue or blue gray. And here's the caption. The Austrian Academy of Sciences, headed by Heinz Fossmann, set out to recruit researchers after a devastating spring for American science. Did I note that Professor Fossmann is smiling? From the View, climate, fossil fuel versus winter sport, by Ukalek Sletemark. Sletemark is a Greenlandic biathlete who competed in the Milano Cortina Olympics for Denmark. I grew up in Greenland, skiing and shooting, and competed for Denmark in biathlon at the Milano Cortina Olympics. But the sport I love is becoming harder to recognize as a winter sport at all. At the World Championships in Chechnya in 2024, I skied on snow that was reduced to a narrow artificial strip, surrounded by grass and mud. Temperatures near to balmy 50 degrees Fahrenheit in the middle of February. In places, I found that the snow was so thin that asphalt broke through underneath my skis. On what was supposed to be a training day on the snow, we were told we were not allowed to ski at all. The organizing committee was struggling to preserve what little snow was left. Too much skiing would only speed up the melting. Winter sports are already being reshaped by climate change, and the institutions that govern them must decide how they will respond. One place to start is with sponsorship. Currently, YX, a Norwegian petrol station chain, sponsors the Norwegian Biathlon Federation. Vår Energi sponsors the Norwegian Alpine National Team. And one of the sponsors of the Milano Cortina Olympics was Eni, an Italian oil and gas company. Imagine the impact if the International Olympic Committee and national sport federations drew a clear line and banned fossil fuel sponsorships altogether. There's a painful irony in winter sports giving oil and gas companies a platform to build public credibility, while the very conditions required for our sport are quite literally melting away. Sponsoring winter sports is a powerful way to gain public credibility. Millions of people watch the Olympic Games, and every logo shown on screen sends a message about what aligns with Olympic values and what the Olympic movement chooses to endorse. I feel extremely privileged to still be able to train and compete, even if it increasingly happens in venues relying on artificial snow. In many places, even that is no longer possible. Last year, several biathlon races in Norway were canceled because of warm temperatures and lack of snow. Across Europe, regions that once had snow-secure winters no longer do. The rapid change we're witnessing has a name we're all familiar with, even if we sometimes prefer not to think about it: climate change. Biathlon is far from the only sport affected. Every outdoor winter sport that depends on snow faces the same threat. In the 2023-2024 season, the International Ski and Snowboard Federation was forced to cancel 26 World Cup races. Lack of snow meant the 50th anniversary of the American Birkebeiner, an amateur cross-country race usually skied in the woods between two northern Wisconsin towns, was run on a loop. Like the sports we love watching at the Olympics, ski jumping, Nordic combined, it requires a future with snow in order to exist. The impacts are already measurable. In the U.S., the average ski season was shortened by 5 to 7 days from 2000 to 2019, and projections suggest this loss could double or triple by 2050 as global temperatures continue to rise. What used to be reliable winter conditions are becoming increasingly fragile. The primary driver of this warming is the continued burning of fossil fuels. Today, renewable alternatives such as solar, wind, and hydropower are cost competitive or even cheaper than fossil fuels in many parts of the world. And yet governments continue to support fossil fuel production and consumption. Climate-related disasters caused more than $100 billion in damages in the U.S. alone in 2025. And climate change is also melting our snow. That affects livelihoods and businesses. The U.S. ski industry calculates it lost $5 billion in the past 2 decades. So how does this affect the Olympic Games by making them much harder to mount? Research referenced by the International Olympic Committee shows that of 93 past and potential Winter Olympics host locations, only 52 are likely to remain snow secure by 2050. By the 2080s, that number could fall to just 30 if emissions remain at today's levels. This year's games happened, but it was a near thing. In the last 70 years since Cortina d'Ampezzo last hosted the Winter Olympics in 1956, the average February temperature there has risen by 6.4 degrees Fahrenheit, 3.6 degrees centigrade. That's meant 41 additional days above freezing. Winter sports must take a clear stand on climate action, starting with the companies we choose as sponsors. Now, Ukalek Sletemark wrote this article, and here's a photo of the author. It's about a quarter page in color, racing in Otepää, Estonia, in March 2025. He is racing with skis, and I don't know the difference from one ski to another, but this does not look like a downhill ski to me. It looks more like a cross-country ski. There's another skier behind him. Now, this Sletemark person, the author, is dressed in blue and white, and he's number 26, and he's wearing a helmet and blue sunglasses, I suppose. The person behind him is dressed in red, white, and blue with the same type of skis. And at this point, they are skiing on what looks like a one-lane road. It really does. It looks about that wide with a minimal uphill grade. So he's not skiing downhill fast. It looks like he's kind of clomping uphill on skis. The Risk Report by Ion Bremmer, contributing editor. Viktor Orban and his Fidesz party have led Hungary since 2010, long enough that they've become a kind of fact of European life. His trademark right-wing populism, his attacks on the EU and its liberal values, and his warnings that support for Ukraine risk conflict with Russia have become a familiar obstacle for efforts in Brussels to maintain EU unity. Over time, Prime Minister Orban has come to dominate Hungary's official media and its courts, and he's built electoral advantages for himself and his party by gaming the country's voting system to win more parliamentary seats with fewer votes via gerrymandering and other gimmicks. It's striking, then, that Fidesz now looks likely to lose Hungary's next national elections, scheduled for April 12. In part, that's because a growing number of voters are exhausted by their country's political and economic stagnation and are eager for a political spring cleaning. Peter Magyar, who defected from Fidesz 2 years ago amid accusations the party had helped hide evidence in a child sexual abuse scandal, is the youthful leader of a newish center-right opposition party called Tisza, which looks ready for a breakout electoral performance. At the moment, Tisza has better than even odds of winning a simple majority. The opposition party has held solid leads in most credible polls in recent weeks, despite Orbán's media dominance and the support of friends his policies have enriched. The incumbent also hopes to win votes with financial handouts, like the extension of lifetime exemptions from income taxes for mothers with two or more children, and a cap on mortgage interest rates. Aware that the challenge to his majority is real, Orbán calls Magyar an EU puppet who will involve Hungary in the war in neighboring Ukraine. But Magyar has found a winning issue, official corruption and its corrosive impact on Hungary's economy. The EU, citing the unwillingness of Orbán's government to observe the rule of law, has withheld billions of euros in funding, a problem now more keenly felt as slow growth, high prices, and failing public education and hospitals plague the country's citizens and consumers. While Fidesz attacks Tisza candidates as inexperienced and inept, many voters, particularly the youngest, welcome them as agents of much-needed change. Tisza candidates promise to boost Hungary's economy by mending fences with Brussels to free up lost funds and by rooting out the corruption, which international watchdogs say is the worst in the EU. Critically, Magyar and his party have carefully avoided taking the bait on many of Orbán's attacks. He also has avoided association with less popular opposition parties and any argument that Hungary should do more to help Ukraine. When U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio appeared in Budapest February 16 to praise Orbán, Magyar skillfully sidestepped any hint of friction with Washington. If Tisza wins in April, Magyar's message discipline will likely be an important reason why. That victory's no sure thing. More than 30% of voters remain undecided in the most recent surveys, and Fidesz's electoral advantages are real. The current system is built to ensure rural constituencies, the core of the ruling party's support, and places where anti-EU nationalism resonate most forcefully, remain the most important element of the final vote count. Tisza will probably have to win the national vote by 4% to 5% to overcome this Orbán advantage. More Fidesz handouts, like higher wages for state workers, pension increases, and help with high energy bills, can still make a difference. And if the opposition wins by a razor-thin margin, Orbán will almost certainly challenge the result by demanding recounts and using courts to delay the election certification. There is a real risk of protests and violence, but for now, Viktor Orbán's near 16-year hold on power is in danger. At a time when Europe's political center of gravity looks to be shifting to the populist right, a Fidesz defeat would signal that the most powerful force in Western democracies remains economic insecurity and anti-incumbent anger. Turning the page to the View inbox, CO2 Leadership Report by Justin Warland, Senior Correspondent. The Environmental Protection Agency's February 12 repeal of its endangerment funding, which underpins all its noteworthy climate rules, was framed by the Trump administration as a big win for American industry. It might better be described as an ideological project that will result in marketplace confusion. Lawsuits will abound, states will try to step into the void, generating more lawsuits and more confusion. Meanwhile, companies will need to decide to what degree they respond. The endangerment funding was never the first best solution to tackle climate change. It came about through a series of contortions. In the early 2000s, after the Bush administration refused to make climate policy, Massachusetts sued, saying the EPA was not doing its job under the 1970 Clean Air Act, passed when climate change was more scientific curiosity than political issue. The Supreme Court ruled the EPA should study whether climate change harmed public health. If so, it had a legal obligation to regulate the greenhouse gases that cause it. In 2009, the EPA released the finding, a resounding yes. From that ruling came a slew of regulations, from tailpipe emission standards for cars to power plant emission rules. These played an important role in U.S. climate progress, but economic shifts and declining cost curves have stimulated clean energy in a way rules could not have done alone. And going forward, global companies will still face regulatory pressure in Europe, Asia, and Latin America. They also know a future U.S. administration may restore the endangerment funding. The endangerment finding. I'm sorry, I'm wondering if that's supposed to read funding, but it says finding. And all the regulations that come with it. Watching the response to the widely anticipated news, I could not help but think of what Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney said in Davos, Switzerland, in January. The old order is not coming back. We should not mourn it. Nostalgia is not a strategy, but we believe that from the fracture we can build something bigger, better, stronger, more just. In completely rupturing climate efforts, President Trump has created a blank slate. No one knows exactly what's next, but it probably should not be the exact same thing as before. Here's an essay on love. Beware the placeholder relationship by Meekika Barua. I'll spell that. The first name is Meehika, last name Barua. Barua is a journalist writing a memoir on friendship and love. A friend of mine got out of a 6-year relationship only to have her ex marry someone new within 6 months. Another woman I met at a networking event recently has been with her boyfriend for a decade, waiting on a ring. Every time they go on a vacation, she wonders if this holiday will be the one where he will propose, only to be dejected on the flight back home. I never had the heart to tell these women they were placeholders, but they fit the bill for a relationship term that's all over social media. A placeholder partner is good enough to date, live with, even spend years alongside, but never the person their partner actually plans to commit to in the long term. They're the in-the-meantime partner till the real one comes along. Now that I'm aware of the idea, it is one of my biggest fears, even as it has taught me my own value. Why do women, these conversations are so often about women, stay in long relationships when their partners have shown no signs of commitment? Often because they've invested so much of their time, love, energy, and focus into the relationship that they imagine a potential life with their partner. Most people do not want to start another relationship because they're terrified of being alone. This is a deeply human fear. Ultimately, though, it holds us back. Louise Yafai, an emotional recovery and resilience coach based in London, notes people are unsure of their own worth. Before you know it, you're in this relationship for months, if not years, and the placeholder relationship is now familiar and normalized, she said. you hope they see your value. I have no intention of waiting around for years in the hopes that a ring will magically appear. Late last year, I went on a date with a guy who told me he had just gotten out of a 3-year relationship. When I asked about the reason for the breakup, he said his ex wanted to move in, and he had no intention of living together. Clearly, there was no second date. I told him I would not stay in a relationship for more than a year if we were not planning to move in, let alone stay for 3 years. That's the thing about my placeholder phobia. I'm very comfortable now telling men the first time I meet them that if I am not engaged within 2 years of dating, I will bolt. I find these boundaries help me be more selective. It is painfully difficult to admit to yourself that you are a placeholder. You are admitting to yourself something terrible, that the person I'm with values me much less than I value them, says Jack Worthy, a licensed psychotherapist in New York. I see this happening in friendships as well. Friends who I spent time with regularly have disappeared for months or years after they get into a relationship. I thought that was normal, till women on TikTok started talking about placeholder friends. They explained some people make friendships only to fill up their time and social calendar till they reach a milestone, like getting a partner, or getting married, or having kids. When one such friend emerged recently after her breakup, I had mixed feelings. On one hand, I had not seen her in over 4 years, during which time she had a baby with her partner of over a decade. On the other hand, I felt bad for her because she herself was a placeholder. I confessed I had always found it odd that her ex never proposed. She said she felt like he had settled, that his ideal woman was someone completely unlike her. "Do you think you were a placeholder all these years?" I asked. She had no idea what that word meant. When I explained the concept, she screamed, "Oh my God, yes, that's exactly what it was." She thanked me for teaching her about it now that she's going back into the dating pool. I wondered if the next time I see her, I should explain placeholder friendships as well. Recognizing placeholder dynamics in relationships, as well as friendships, is an act of self-love. Naming it gives people permission to leave situations that drain their time. The right person, it turns out, won't make you wait. Education, the future of college. What might the world's top universities of 2026 look like tomorrow? By Raj Chetty and John Friedman. Chetty and Friedman are co-directors of Opportunity Insights, which studies the science of economic opportunity. Today's debate over the future of higher education is often framed as a choice between diversity and mediocrity, as if universities must choose between the identity and quality of their students. But while that paradigm fits into the extreme partisan politics of today, a better question may center on the role of wealth in the admission process. What if we could design admission policies that are more meritocratic and increase socioeconomic diversity? The tension is reflected in Time's new ranking of the world's top universities in partnership with data firm Statista. The ranking places emphasis on the extent to which students achieve extraordinary success, for instance, in patenting new inventions or rising to leadership roles in business. It is structured around three pillars: academic capacity and performance via statistics like expenditures per student, faculty to student ratios, research citations, and Nobel Prizes. Innovation and economic impact via things like patents filed and online courses, and global engagement, which takes into account international students and faculty. Institutions receive scores on each pillar, which were then aggregated into a final score. These lists help us understand where students are likely to achieve the greatest success and contribute most to society as the world order shifts. U.S. and U.K. universities continue to lead in academic performance, while China's universities are catching up in innovation and economic impact. But they also reveal an uncomfortable reality. In most countries, these top universities are most accessible to children from high-income families, limiting their socioeconomic diversity. Our own research using big data to study the outcomes of millions of college students over time underscores this point in the U.S. Fewer than 1% of Americans attend the 12 Ivy Plus colleges, the 8 Ivy League schools, plus Stanford, MIT, Duke, and the University of Chicago. Yet they account for over 13% of those in the top 0.1% of earners, a quarter of U.S. senators, half of all Rhodes Scholars, and three-fourths of Supreme Court justices appointed in the past half century. These institutions do not merely select talented students, but change their life trajectories. Comparing waitlisted students who are accepted versus rejected from these institutions, we find that those who attend an Ivy Plus college are far more likely to reach the top 1% of earners, work at prestigious firms, achieve success in other dimensions. Selective colleges have extraordinary influence. Because these institutions offer a unique pipeline to leadership positions, it's important they select students in ways that provide the broadest possible access within the most qualified students. For many, the primary justification for this priority is moral. There is perhaps no more widely shared principle than equality of opportunity. The belief that a child's opportunities should not depend on family background, income, or zip code. But even setting aside this principle, there's a powerful pragmatic case for diversity. Nations grow faster when they tap into the broadest talent pool to contribute to society. No one benefits from excluding those who could have discovered life-saving drugs, started companies that grow the economy, or improved communities through creative work in government or the nonprofit sector. Unfortunately, the data show that access to top universities for talented students outside the traditional elite is much more restricted than it ought to be. Our research on the 12 Ivy Plus colleges in the U.S., all of which rank among Time's top 60, shows that students from wealthy backgrounds are heavily overrepresented. More than 15% come from families in the top 1% of the U.S. income distribution, who have incomes above $600,000 per year. Data from other countries also bear this out. For instance, students from private high schools in the UK account for nearly half of those at Oxford and Cambridge, ranked number 1 and 7, despite accounting for just 7% of all high school students. In Chile, students from elite private schools are 16 times as likely as the average student to enroll in the most selective programs at the nation's top universities, University of Chile and Pontificia University. That's Pontificia Universidad Católica. The pattern's clear. The world's most influential universities serve society's most privileged families. One might imagine The lack of socioeconomic diversity arises from differences in resources, such as the quality of schools children attended, or the neighborhoods in which they grew up. But much of it arises purely from admission policies. Consider two students who apply with an SAT score of 1,500, one from a family in the top 1% and another from a middle-class family. The student from the high-income family is more than twice as likely to be admitted to an Ivy Plus college, and a student whose parents are executives is far more likely to be admitted to top-ranked colleges than one with the same high school test scores and grades whose parents are teachers or bus drivers. In fact, if students from the top 1% were admitted to Ivy Plus schools at the same rate as middle-class students with the same SAT or ACT scores, the share of students from the top 1% at America's top colleges would fall by nearly half. Three factors drive the high-income admission advantage. Legacy preferences, which keep privilege in the family by giving priority to children of alumni and their potential donations. Non-academic ratings and athletic recruitment. Applicants from top 1% families whose parents attended an Ivy Plus college are five times as likely to be admitted to an Ivy Plus college as peers with comparable credentials whose parents did not attend. Students from high-income families also score higher on non-academic aspects, largely because they're more likely to attend private high schools with greater access to extracurriculars, college counseling, and other support for the application process. Recruited athletes who, perhaps surprisingly to many outside America, make up 10% to 15% of top American universities' incoming students also skew heavily toward high-income families who are able to provide the support needed for students to excel in athletics. One might be able to justify these admission preferences if they helped universities find students with unusually high potential. But our data show just the opposite. These admission advantages do not predict future success. Legacy students, those with higher non-academic ratings, and recruited athletes are no more likely, and often less likely, to reach top income levels or work at prestigious companies than comparable Ivy Plus applicants. By contrast, academic factors such as test scores and grades are highly predictive of post-college outcomes. The bottom line is, the debate about meritocracy versus diversity misses the point. When we measure merit by what predicts success, not by parental wealth, meritocracy can actually increase diversity. Admitting students to top-ranked colleges on the basis of their own merit would increase the representation of students from middle-class families on campuses and expand the talent pool for businesses. Top American universities that serve as gateways to leadership could both broaden access and strengthen meritocratic norms by focusing more heavily on indicators of academic potential and reducing preferences that primarily track family income. Eliminating legacy preferences, reducing the weight placed on non-academic factors, and being more transparent about admission criteria would help move these institutions closer to a meritocracy while opening their doors to a wider group of students. Expanding access to colleges that are pathways to success is particularly important in this era of growing mistrust of the establishment. Admission policies that present non-meritocratic barriers to many students reinforce the perception that elite universities protect privilege instead of cultivating talent. This is not to say diversity and academic merit will never be in tension in college admissions. especially given the large disparities in access to high-quality K-12 education and other resources before children apply to college. But for now, opening the gates of the world's top universities based on talent rather than income stands to benefit everyone, not just graduates. Time is featuring women during this Women's History Month, and here's a notable figure from TV, Mariska Hargitay. This is going to be just one paragraph. Finding Power Through Vulnerability, last year veteran actor and advocate Mariska Hargitay, known to millions as the fearless Captain Olivia Benson, whom she's portrayed on Law and Order Special Victims Unit, for nearly three decades stepped into a new role. Documentary filmmaker, her feature film directorial debut, My Mom Jane, J-A-Y-N-E, Hargitay examined the life, career, and complicated legacy of her mother, 1950s and 60s Hollywood starlet Jane Mansfield, who died in a 1967 car accident at 34 when Hargitay was just 3.5 years old. I wanted to make a movie that recognized the whole person without judgment, she says. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.